Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. All About Languages with Kerry Bevan.
Hello and welcome to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a guest in the studio today. I'm calling it a studio quite loosely, Tom.
Yes.
We should probably describe
we
our
should
surroundings.
Describe the fact that once again, people with power tools have descended with very little warning and necessitated the building of an emergency temporary studio far away. So our small but mighty band of YouTube subscribers, I'm afraid you can't see us for this episode.
And we are not alone. You can't see that either. We have, I'm going to say, a friend of the podcast. You're a friend if you come back. And you've certainly been on in the past. Kerry Bevan, how are you doing? Welcome.
Very well. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, who's an enemy of the podcast?
Oh! Oh, that's an episode all of its own.
Enemy of the podcast.
Well, you were definitely not an enemy of the podcast. You did a cracking episode for us. I cannot remember how long ago. It feels like it was quite a while ago
It was.
On decolonising languages.
Yes.
It was your
languages.
Master's. Yes. That was it. Secondary languages. And you'd used, some of your participants were your ITE students. So for those who can't remember, Kerry, you're here on our PGC programmes. You are the glorious programme leader of languages here at Cardiff Met. How do you feel about that?
Indeed. Yeah, I absolutely love my job and it's a real privilege to work with student teachers as they embark on their journey in a profession that I have worked in for many, many years and enjoy working in.
And your languages are no longer either modern or foreign, I notice.
They're definitely not. So we've removed both of those titles from our course and we are just now secondary languages, which may cause a little bit of confusion, but is far more inclusive and reflective of the curriculum for Wales. And the language landscape. So yes, we're just secondary languages.
And we might get into that actually, because this episode is one of our sort of building suite of episodes that we seem to have now about the nature of a discipline in mainstream education. And today we're looking at languages. So who better to go to than our esteemed colleague, Kerry? So what we have been tending to ask as a sort of opening gambit is quite a big question, but you know, I'm sure you'll be well placed to tackle this, is what are the nature and purpose of languages as a subject discipline? You know, so what is it? What is its purpose? What is its nature, particularly in a sort of mainstream setting?
Well, that is a huge question to start with. Traditionally, languages haven't sat at the heart of our curriculum, and that's a fact. We are often marginalised. We're not a compulsory subject, so we're one of many, many subjects that are options. But actually, languages education, and I mean languages in its widest sense, actually serves multiple interconnected purposes that extend beyond the words. And I think many people, when they think about language learning, they just think about learning maybe a set of vocabulary, some words around the weather or going to the doctors or some thematic vocabulary. But actually, it's not about that, really. It's about this intercultural competence. It's about enabling our learners to understand and navigate different worldviews, which sounds really grand, but it is about having sort of a window into another culture, cultural practices, way of thinking. Of course, that includes the language, but it also includes the music, the food, the history, the literature. The words are just a way of seeing into that other world. And in fact, they act as a bridge between cultures. And in today's society, where things are difficult, you know, life is very difficult and conflicts around the world require perhaps a greater level of empathy and global citizenship and understanding. Languages allow you to do that because you can understand why people are thinking and saying things that they do based on their history, etc.
And I'm interested in the point that you made about you alluded to its place in the curriculum. Can you give us sort of a sense of how here in Wales, here in the UK, it's sort of been prioritised, deprioritised? What's that sort of been stemming from?
So I'm sure your listeners are aware, if they, you know, if they're, they're people who are sort of invested in languages, that actually languages were compulsory on the curriculum until Tony Blair decided that that wasn't going to be the case under the last Labour government. And at that point, they became an option, which, you know, for reasons that were obvious at the time, that's fine. But what we've seen in most recent years, and this is here in Wales and in the UK, and my colleague Dr. Ian Collin, who writes reports on language trends in Wales, but also in Northern Ireland, in England and in Scotland, what you notice is a very steep downward curve in the uptake of languages at GCSE and at A-level, and that is not improving. That's for a variety of reasons. That's not just because we're not compulsory.
It's been a bit of a British thing, I suppose, has it? It's less of a hard sell, perhaps, in some non-English-speaking countries, I guess. I'm interested in that point about cultural awareness as well, because I have fond memories of studying a German book, which was a set of interviews with young people, you know, people my age when I was doing my A-levels, about how they felt about being, as the title said, born guilty. So, you know, having this sort of guilt about the Second World War when it had happened before they were born. And lots of these German kids were like really angry or really sort of almost kind of quite messed up about it. And I learned a lot about the youth of Germany through studying German. I'm amazed that Tony Blair, of all people, took it off the compulsory list, because you sort of look back at
I'm almost pretty sure it was under that government that it became non-compulsory. And actually in England you've seen the EBAC. So we have seen an attempt to include it in the tracking of grades in England. But in Wales it's been left to schools to decide whether or not it's compulsory. And I am, for the vast majority of schools it wouldn't be. Welsh as a language, which is absolutely vital, is compulsory. And that there is a conflict, and that it would be naive of any of us to say that that conflict doesn't exist. I don't think it exists from us as language teachers or from policymakers, but it exists in the eyes of the learner.
Yeah.
So the learner often will have a conversation and say, well, I'm already taking a foreign language. And then you have to remind them that actually Welsh is the indigenous language of this country, and it's fantastic, and they should be learning that. But also they should be considering the fact that French, German, Spanish, Arabic, Russian, Mandarin, all of those languages also have a really valid role to play.
I was going to ask you, actually, what's the evolution been in terms of languages? Because I know when I was a kid, it was French, German, and a little bit of Italian was available as well, and then the Italian went, and then I think the German went, and now you hear a lot more about Mandarin and Spanish. Yeah, that's a really big
Spanish.
One yeah, yeah. Did you mm-hmm. I didn't do Spanish, but they did Spanish in the school where I taught, so by that stage it was a French and Spanish sort of thing. What's, because I know you're a German specialist.
German mainly. And French. German, so I'm French. A dual linguist, but yes, so we've seen, and this is again not reflective of necessarily the landscape in Wales, but we've seen a downward trend. German is basically being pushed to the margins of the curriculum in Wales. Very, very few, particularly A-level numbers. We're talking below 100 across Wales.
Schlecht.
Is ganz schlecht. And that's really quite concerning for our largest European trading partner. And you know, if we go back to, again, ideas as to why people think languages are not important, this idea that, you know, everybody speaks English and therefore, you know, if you just shout a bit louder in English, that's okay because they'll understand you. I actually, you know, that it's not, as I said before, it's not just about the words. It's about understanding. It's about opening that window into someone else's culture and way of life and how they think and do business, for example. The Germans do business differently. You know, the way they act, the way they behave, the way they structure a sentence is different. And that can cause misunderstandings. So, yeah, what we've noticed is downward trend in German. French has also dropped. Spanish has picked up, but also it can ride in a wave. But it is more popular. England, the most recent language trends report from Dr. Collin and his colleagues in Belfast is that Spanish is now outperforming, or, you know, there are more people studying Spanish than the others. Mandarin, not so much in Wales, has picked up in England. There was a Department for Education sort of push financially to promote Mandarin. It's just not really sat so much here. It's been at sort of after school clubs, but I think there is a place for it. Mm. But we would need to obviously train teachers and have more schools maybe prepared to offer that. as a subject. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, it's difficult. And this is why we often, when we meet our student teachers at the start of their initial teacher education year or course, thinking about purpose. It's very Curriculum for Wales, isn't it, to start with the why? But it's actually, it's then that you start to get a sense of philosophy, even if it's early doors, you know. So that was fascinating to me that you mentioned that it's so much more than just saying the words. And I'm reflecting on, you know, some of the Spanish education that I had, and it seems to me that it very much came across to me as about saying the words and less about that cultural awareness. That, you know, is this a thing, and does this find its way into pedagogy?
It's a great question, because I think actually it isn't always a thing. So I think we're driven by targets which might be the Curriculum for Wales statement for what matters, but it also might be the WJC specification. And yes, we've got a wonderful new spec coming, and I'm going to say that because I think it is great. And there is an element now around literature, which is a cultural reflection. But I think that actually, no, I think you're right. I think for the majority of teachers, it is about equipping their students with the communication skills. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that one is that we can do without the communication skills. Absolutely, that they're vital. But I think it is a bigger package. And I don't think there is enough time spent reflecting upon cultural influences, whether that be history or music. I mean, I'm going to take an example, going back to my decolonizing work that you mentioned earlier. You know, we spend a lot of time in French lessons talking about where they speak French around the world. We celebrate that. It's fantastic. They speak it in, I don't know, Côte d'Ivoire. They speak it in Guadeloupe. They speak it in Canada. But actually, we don't actually explore that very deeply. We don't really explain why. Mm. So we don't look at the historical background into that as to, you know, why French actually is a global language. We don't explore whether those countries particularly want French as an official language. Many of them don't. Many of those African countries don't want it. North African countries, if you go to somewhere like Morocco, you might see the French translation crossed out, actually in a sign, because they don't want that. They see that as the language of the oppressor. So, you know, I think there's a lot to do. And I think maybe our learners, and again, I always think I live in a very idealistic sort of world where, you know, if only we had more time, we could do more of this. But I do think if we had more time to explore some of these themes, maybe our learners would actually opt to choose our subject, because otherwise it does just feel like a list of learning words and some grammar points.
Yeah, and I wonder what does that do at the primary phase and that sort of end of things, you know? And I'm not even sure I'm using as I'm even asking this. Like, the question that's in my head is where do you start and how do you engage them in the why of learning a language? Does it have to be one or the other, or, you know, is it a bit of both?
Definitely. And I think the Curriculum for Wales makes that quite clear. You know, we celebrate the idea of multilingualism, and that is highlighted from the very start of sort of primary school. That celebration of our learners, who for so many of them, I think I read an article that talked about 1/5 of children in, and it might have just been England, but I think it was the UK, entering school now actually have another language. And although I know that's still a minority, that's quite a big number, 20% of children who have that. And I think if we start early and celebrate that idea of multilingualism, allowing learners to make those authentic connections between languages, you know, looking at a word and saying, oh, that looks a bit like the word in my language. Actually, the word for orange, which we know is actually an Arabic word originally, you know, oh, that's just what we say. And allowing them to celebrate that, giving them space to do that. And I don't, again, just mean having some sort of day of everybody dresses up in someone else's outfits and we celebrate culture that way. I mean meaningfully in the classroom, allowing a celebration of multilingualism. I think it can be done. And the Curriculum for Wales does outline that.
I'm thinking about my own little boy now who's in primary school. He's desperate to be able to speak Arabic because all his little mates speak Arabic here in central Cardiff. He'd love to be able to speak Arabic because sometimes his mates, you know, break into Arabic and he doesn't know what they're saying.
But I also think the Curriculum for Wales, without saying that we have to teach French, German, Spanish or Italian, actually does allow for that navigation of another language. And why couldn't we, for example, in year five, allow a teacher to come and teach Arabic? And the next year, we could do Japanese. I don't necessarily see that it has to be a complete progression at that stage. I think it is about allowing them linguistic opportunities and cultural opportunities, which actually will allow them to learn whichever language is offered at the secondary later on. I don't think it has to be progressive.
And this makes me think about, whenever we talk about subjects, we often talk about, well, what's the traps you fall into as a novice teaching that subject? And, you know, Emma and I've banged on forever about all the sort of traps you can fall into in music and drama. And I've been thinking about the languages lessons I've watched on my travels in this job. And, you know, some fantastic, some, you know, a bit more work to do. And when there's a bit more work to do, it seems to me, I don't know, you can shoot me down here, Kerry, if you think I'm talking rubbish, but where they don't quite work so well as lessons, it's because they've just become a string of games or drills without a sort of story to hold it together.
Absolutely. I think that's one of my biggest things, is that I think language lessons can feel a bit like a very quick sequence of activities. And as a novice teacher, without understanding, if you were to just look at it from the outside, you might think that's what you have to mirror. Actually, it's much more complex, as we know. And it really can't just be a sequence of keeping children. I think Estin will talk about keeping children busy. It's not about that. It's about, you know, how am I going to, by the end, how are my learners going to be able to confidently use, I don't know, something like I would be able to? And how can I do that in a sequence of different types of listening and reading and writing, perhaps skill-like activities? But it's, you're right, I think where they do fall, it's just, it's seen as a very quick task type lesson, which, yeah, I think causes difficulties for the learners as well, because just like you on my travels, I've watched quite a few other lessons. And actually, this year I spent quite a lot of time thinking about it, Tom, thinking about how different we are, and I'm talking language lessons, international languages, to all the other subjects. Strikingly so, like really strikingly so. I can watch a history lesson where children, learners of any age are allowed to explore and investigate for 20 minutes and do some group work and some pair work, and the teacher can check in and it can be effective. And yet in a language lesson, I'm consistently watching this 3 minute, 4 minute, 5 minute, ding, 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 which is exhausting for the novice teacher, but also for the learners.
And I was wondering as you were talking, actually, because like this seems to, well, again, from memory, it was a lot of practice. I wonder, has Duolingo sort of catapulted this even more? And the gamification of, you know, those sorts of approaches, quick quizzes, you know. How do you, it's going to sound like a really obtuse question, I don't want to do your subject a service, but like, what opportunity, is it harder to facilitate things like creative thinking and synthesis and, you know, those sort of the higher Blooms. Order, yeah, and thinking sort of Blooms or Solar, whatever taxonomy is your choice. Is that difficult to achieve in languages lessons when you're working mostly with novices to that language?
I think it can be, because if you think about it, what we're asking, if you have a child of 11 who comes in and doesn't know any French, what you're trying to instill in them is knowledge that maybe a 1 or 2 year old of first language, so English, would have been doing. We're talking about numbers, colours, pets. You know, if you were reading with a child first language English at the age of 2 and before, you'd be looking at a book and you'd be getting them to repeat words. You'd be pointing, show me the dog, show me the cat, show me the ball. Oh, is that the dog or the cat? Is that the ball? So you would be doing that as a parent or a carer, as a grandparent, on a regular basis, continually. So if you think about that, first language exposure is just all the time, even to the unborn child. We're talking all the time and they are absorbing that. We might have 1 hour a week. In some schools, I've seen that. 1 hour a week to deliver and try and replicate that. So you do feel that actually it's very difficult then to sort of to make progress and in any way to come away from that sort of quick win. We've got to do some tasks to show some progress in this hour. very, very hard.
And does assessment, particularly sort of statutory assessment, compound the issue? If it's privileging, is that old, you know, is it Dylan William quote, or is it Donaldson? I can't remember it anymore. We value what we assess. Do we assess what we value? Is that the problem? You know, are they privileging certain things at assessment level? I know, you know, it's all about formative assessment and progression when it comes to Curriculum for Wales, yeah. But ultimately you get to GCSE, you get to A level.
Yeah, and I think, and teachers will be guided by that, because ultimately what they've got to be able at GCSE still to do is listen, just as we would have done. You have to listen to tasks, you have to be able to understand them, you have to be able to read something and answer questions, you have to be able to write a blog about your school or to your invented pen pal that you've never met before, you know, so they're quite sort of a lack of creativity maybe tasks. You went back talking about creativity before. We do have a new element, which is literature, which is lovely, but yes, I think we are driven by what we want them to achieve eventually. So we know that they're going to have to be able to write in three tenses, so somehow we manufacture that into a lesson about holidays, and we talk about what we do now and what we did last weekend and what we'll do in the future. And that sort of, it is driven by the assessment process. Mm. But that wouldn't, I don't think, maybe be that different maybe for other subjects. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, is that a problem? I'm just musing, and I wonder, where do parents and carers sit on this? You know, what are they expecting? Are they hoping that, you know, their child's going to gradually become more proficient and therefore be able to converse when they go to France, when they go, like, or do they have to, you know, would they be convinced by what you said about it being about culture and
sort of holistic
transcultural awareness?
Do you think, I think we have a naive understanding that actually by GCSE that somebody would be, for want of a better word, fluent. If you look, and we don't use that framework, but there is a European framework of assessing languages which other European countries use, and you start off at A1 and it goes to C1. So C1 and C2 is proficient, you're very fluent, that's undergraduate level. GCSE sits around A2. I think that, and it does A1, A2, B1, B2, C1.
Wow.
It would be very naive. You think, I talked about 1 hour a week, so if you had 1 hour a week in years 7, 8 and 9, and then you have maybe 4 hours a fortnight at GCSE, you're not going to be fluent. What you will be able to do is, I'm hoping, and again with the new curriculum, the new GCSE, which is a little bit more communicative again, is that you will be able to go and order a ticket at a station. You will be able to order your coffee and understand, you know, how much it costs. You will be able to go to a pharmacist. And people might say, well, that's, you know, quite basic language. But actually, it's very, very difficult. We're talking not only, and it goes back to what is languages, we're not just talking about some vocabulary. We're talking about being able to construct a grammatical sentence in the correct tense with the correct person. So there's lots and lots of things going on. It's not just, and that's again where it is about regular practice. It's not just about some words. But it's about other understanding as well. Knowing, for example, should I use tu or vous or zi or do, you know, the you form, even all of those things a learner is trying to process. It's a lot, and no, they're not going to be fluent to go to France to, you know, to have a conversation.
Even my A-level German at grade 8, no, A-low-less, required the addition of a pint or two before I could speak confidently to the Erasmus students at university.
And I think that goes back to another issue that we do have, which is around confidence. And this idea that you have to be, it has to be 100% right, and you have to sound absolutely bang on like somebody from Paris. I think we need to move away from that, because again, our learners can't meet those demands. And so, because it takes so much courage for a learner, particularly after year 7. I'm going to say after year 7, because I think that's when we stop to lose the enthusiasm. My years of experience, that's normally where we peter off. But it takes so much confidence and so much to actually just accept that we're going to make mistakes. And I know it goes back to that sort of fixed and mindset, and whether we've got, you know, a mindset that is accepting that mistakes are really good. Actually, they are really important. And you think, you know, if you go back to like first language learning and the amount of errors that children make along their way, you know, for example, you take the ED rule for the past tense. I played, I looked, I danced. And then they try to apply that rule as learners and they say, I goed to the shops, mummy. And then you have to gradually, you don't sort of no, which is what might happen in a language classroom. No, I've told you it's not that. It's a... Oh, did you? We went to the shops. We went, and you sort of keep saying it. And by force of sort of you saying it, the child then picks up on that. So confidence is just such a big issue, I think, in language teaching.
Let's think about some red lines for your subject then, because you've sort of hinted that there are some really nice opportunities, particularly with the kind of additional flexibility that the Curriculum for Wales framework gives you. But perhaps, you know, let's not be parochial about this. Just if you are a really creative, really sort of aspirational person that really wants to kind of embed languages and make it more than just games and words and vocabulary, about, you know, celebrating cultures and finding out about really interesting histories. And you've talked about, you know, the French Empire in North Africa. Yeah. And of course, you know, there's loads of interesting stuff about French history connected to that as well, you know, De Gaulle and all of that. But I guess there is the danger that you could then go all in on all of that stuff
yep.
and then lose some really, really important stuff that is the essence of language teaching in your sort of enthusiasm. And all of a sudden, a specialist like you is going, that's lovely, but we've actually lost some real red lines of it stopped being language teaching as I know it. So for the benefit of anybody who perhaps would like to have, you know, have a stab at making this a bit more holistic or a bit more embedded into a curriculum, what would be the things to watch out for that if they're gone, we've got ourselves a problem?
I think you're right. So if we were just to be looking at history and geography, then we're no longer languages. So actually the communication is vital. We can't be, it's not languages teaching or education unless we are teaching about meaningful communication with speakers of that language around the globe. And I don't just mean an academic, you know, again, filling in the gap, right tense, etc., but actually meaningful communication. So yes, absolutely, Tom, I'm with you. We are not languages unless we're delivering that. I actually don't think we're languages unless the learners hear the target language. It's one of my little bugbears as I go around. Looking at lessons is that I don't feel there's enough target language used for a whole variety of reasons. Time is one of them. Teachers fearful that if they say it in another language and they have to say it in English anyway, so they've just wasted their time. But I actually think if you've only got 1 hour, it's not language learning unless they're hearing it, unless they are being, and I don't mean completely immersed that you're confusing the child, but unless you're regularly using the language. I don't think it's language learning unless you treat error as part of learning. So if you don't actually see that we have to embrace that and that it's a journey that we're all going on and we'll all make mistakes, then if we don't do that in language learning, then, you know, we can basically write ourselves off. I think we need to maintain relevance to the world around us. I think, you know, we need to show them, and I don't just mean job relevance, because that does worry me a little bit, this obsession with it's okay because we've sort of told our learners that they all need to learn French and German because they can be a physiotherapist for the Toulouse rugby team. I'm just, for want of a better example. Actually, no, it's about the skills. It goes back to my empathy, goes back to all sorts of communication, problem solving. In fact, many of the skills, I would say, Tom, that actually our subjects align with. I think if we don't maintain those, then again, it's not language teaching. If we're not showing the learners that actually all of the things they do are relevant to the world. I do think culture has to be there along the way, but I don't think it's not at the expense of actually teaching them how to communicate in another language.
Something our listeners won't necessarily know about you is that you teach Welsh to beginners.
Yes.
And you are not a Welsh speaker. You wouldn't describe yourself as a Welsh speaker?
No, I would describe myself as a Welsh learner.
There we go. And so I would imagine a big potential barrier to teaching languages is not being a specialist of languages or the language. And so you're in quite a unique position in that you have the perspective of both a non-specialist and a specialist of teaching language. So you must know all about what somebody who is not a language specialist might face about teaching that language. So what have you found and how have you overcome those things in your own practice?
So I can talk about overcoming straight away, because I think overcoming is the fact that I have so much experience of breaking language down to be able to teach beginners. So I know the pedagogy of effective language learning. The barriers are there are lots of them, Emma, to be honest. One of them is around just error correction or knowing synonyms, knowing alternative ways of saying things. If you're not particularly fluent in a language, it makes it very difficult to sort of look for an alternative way to say something, or even to sometimes, you know, accurately correct. If someone then says to me, well, how do you say, you know, I would have done it, which is a very complex sentence and sound very complex, but it is in linguistic terms, you know, actually we're sending them to Shoned just to check out a bit of their homework. It is actually very difficult. And also you can hear from myself, I'm not actually Welsh. So the cultural understanding sometimes doesn't mean that I've not embraced it in my last 11 years here. My children, as you know, Tom and Emma, are in Welsh medium education. So, you know, I understand how all of that works, but I haven't grown up with that same sort of, that those sort of cultural references that people might take for granted. And that happens a lot, I think, in language teaching. They're incidental stories that you would tell sometimes as a linguist, or incidental ways of learning things that you had to learn. They're quite difficult. But what I do have and I can rely on is sort of how to scaffold, you know, how to make things more simple and how to then add up and make that more complex. So I rely on my own subject experience of language teaching, but I'm not always comfortable, let me put it that way.
So is it harder to be a language teacher of a language that you speak natively?
It can be, I think, actually, because I think you do it intuitively. So if you listen sometimes to first language speakers, and I've had the privilege of working with them, you know, sort of French teachers who grew up and were born in France, and actually they didn't have to learn necessarily how to form the perfect tense, didn't have to go through all the rules of is it être, is it avoir, because they just did
had it by osmosis.
Exactly. Yeah. And that process that we talked about earlier of when you make mistakes, you would just be corrected automatically and then you go to school. So yeah, it can be. They've got the advantage though of just having this wealth and richness of vocabulary, you know, that just appear to them. So the idea of particular A-level teaching, when you're looking for those complex synonyms and expressions, they didn't have to learn them. But I think there is something about having learned a language that allows you insight into the difficulties that your learners are having. So when mine, you know, if my year seven will say, but Madame Bevan, you know how to say that. I said, but I had to learn it just like you. And, you know, that empathy that I talked about right at the start about being a window into another culture. Actually, I understand the difficulties that they're going through. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some complexities, but there are definitely some benefits of being a first language speaker.
Okay, so I think what I want to go back to, just circle back just a little bit more, just because I think there's probably more to say about it, is anything that non-subject specialists, you talked about breaking things down. Like, is there anything else that's distinctive about language pedagogy that somebody who is coming at this for the first time, or indeed somebody who wanted to go and observe outside of the subject area, could be looking out for that's quite distinctive about being in a languages classroom?
I think going back to if you're not comfortable, you would find it very difficult to correct anything. So whether that's, and I'm not just talking about grammar, but even pronunciation, you wouldn't have a sense. And French, for example, is a complex language to pronounce. A load of letters that the French put at the end of a word that we don't say. It's very difficult to model something if you yourself don't know how to say something. You can't ask the learner to read it and be able to apply English phonics, because they don't work. So that's very, very difficult for a non-specialist. And then not having that means you can't use any target language, really. So you can't use the incidental, écoutez, asseyez-vous, you know, whatever it happens to be, if you don't know the language. Mm. I think another thing that comes through clearly is if you don't have any subject knowledge for languages, you can possibly put a PowerPoint up and it could have some audio embedded, but you wouldn't really have any necessarily passion for it. You wouldn't have any cultural understanding of the language of perhaps an idiom or why there's masculine and feminine, or the detail of the language itself, you wouldn't have that. Mm. I think it's really challenging, actually, for a non-specialist.
And where do you stand on, because you often will see sometimes a distinct difference between those who insist on speaking the language as much as possible when they're teaching and when they're conversing with students in the classroom, and those who are maybe a little bit looser on that. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah, I think it's really important. That use of the target language, the use of the French, the German, the Arabic, I think is really, really important. And the more the learner can see it as something normal, that it isn't something performative just for an assessment, just to be able to meet a particular standard. As long as they start to see it as an interaction, as that's the way we'll communicate in our classroom. If you think about the immersion that children go through, my daughter was born in London, didn't come to Wales until she was three, and we put her in Meithrin in a Welsh medium. I think she cried for quite a long time, my husband tells me. I was at work, and I probably would have taken her out, actually, if I'd have seen her. But actually, that immersion, that process of listening every day to somebody in Welsh who they don't translate for you, by the end of the first term, she was fine. And actually, she was okay, and she, you know, she's continued to flourish. I think being surrounded by the words, I think, is really quite important. And I think it's a non-negotiable for me, I'm afraid.
One of the reasons that we're doing this kind of occasional series of episodes about subjects is that we do spend quite a lot of time here in teacher education bringing subjects together. And it's partly because of this idea in Curriculum for Wales that you've got the kind of agency to do that, and just partly because we've kind of got the space to do it. And one of the things I think we have learned during the course of it is that people have funny ideas about subjects. And sometimes those ideas are just sort of funny ideas, and sometimes those are ideas that are like out and out offensive to the people that teach them. And, you know, it can be a real problem because people often don't even realise that they're actually saying things about subjects that could really upset people who've kind of spent so long involved in those subjects. So one of the things, and you've done a certain amount of this, I think, in this episode so far, but just to give you the opportunity, as we give everybody really, to sort of myth bust your subject. So what do people think about languages as a subject and those who teach them, which you kind of wish they didn't?
Well, the first thing I think is that they do think that you either have it or you don't have it, both as a teacher, but as a learner, that there's a special ingredient, and we're a special talent for languages, which then would write off the vast majority of learners and those that can and those that can't. And that's the fixed mindset that I talked about earlier. That's just nonsense. We all have an aptitude. We all speak one, if not multiple languages. So we all have an aptitude for learning languages. It's about the support and the motivation and the way it's done. But it's definitely not, they can't do it. That myth, I think, that needs to go. And that also leads to an elitism that's existed in our subject, and maybe in yours too, Tom, slightly.
Yes.
And that still exists. And actually, the most recent report, that language trends that I talked about earlier, the report in England talks about actually affluent schools having more access to language learning than the rest of the children. So again, it creates this elite idea that, you know, we are something special. We're not something special. We're an absolute integral part of communication literacy. Actually, if we go back to why we're important, understanding another language helps you understand and unpick your own language. So once you're starting to learn about adjectives and nouns and verbs and tenses, you start to have questions about how your language works. And those cognitive sort of discussions or thoughts that you have are really, really important. So that's a really important one, I think, Tom, around...
Yeah. I think Carl Matton writes really well about this, about music. I've probably brought this before, but I was going to drop it in before you bust another myth, which is that he's asked students what they think of subjects, and that basically for music they think that first of all you've got to have secret sauce to be good at it, and secondly you've got to have loads and loads of technical skill as well, and that basically life is too short and that's why nobody does music. I wouldn't mind betting, actually, if I went back to his article, I wouldn't mind betting languages is probably sitting somewhere very similar on his quadrant graph.
I think we've had the conversation before. Yeah. And I think they do sit quite closely. Yeah, and that myth doesn't help us.
No.
Because then neither parents nor learners nor teachers want to do it. Another myth is around, I think, that we just memorise words. It goes back to the conversation that you both sort of alluded to at the start, is that we're just about learning pets and pencil cases. And if any of my students are listening, they'll laugh because they know it's my biggest bugbear, is this idea of just learning words. I think that, again, that creates an outdated view about creative, communicative, even analytical aspects of language learning. We talked earlier about, you know, perhaps some of our language learning is perhaps at the lower sort of, maybe not the synthesis, maybe not the analysis, but actually as we increase our language learning, there are aspects of that. Maybe that technology is going to replace us, Tom. That might be one. Maybe we're all a bit fearful of that in the teaching profession. That you talked about Duolingo earlier. There's definitely a place for that. There's some amazing apps and websites out there. But actually what they can't do is replicate that human empathy. Mm. They can't do the bit about the nuanced communication, the cultural understanding. That isn't what any of those apps or websites do. They just teach you language and verbs and tenses and words. I think they might be my top three.
It's interesting, actually. There are quite a few papers out there about the use of drama pedagogies in the languages classroom, and them having quite a lot of efficacy in, you know, just using something as simple as role play.
Put yourself in
those situations. I wondered if, because we're sort of coming to a close on this deep dive into your subject now, but thinking about those out there who may not have listened to your previous episode, and I don't want to sort of go, because we could talk about this for another hour. However, you alluded to it at the start of the episode. If somebody is, you know, really starting to think a bit more critically about their language's pedagogy, are there any sort of good places to start or things to start thinking about? I mean, the one that springs to mind that you got me thinking about in your previous episode was about gendering of languages. It certainly came through in Spanish. I never questioned it, and it was never even a thing it was just, this is how it is. Whereas we're a lot more sort of aware of that now. So if someone is sort of thinking, okay, how can I do this in a way that's in the spirit of decolonizing, about inclusion, etc., are there any sort of things that you'd want to bring to the fore in this episode?
I think it's really important. I can't think of anything. Well, I would actually recommend reading a NALA report about inclusion and disadvantaged learners, and the idea of making sure that your curriculum in your language lessons is as inclusive as possible. And I'm not just talking about decolonizing. I'm talking about ensuring that everyone can access the curriculum. So it goes back to the thing about talking about holidays, making sure that actually, can all of your learners access that? Do all of your learners go on holiday? The answer is no. And the idea that you can just make it up, I don't think is very fair to our learners, because we're not asking them to be creative in the sense of English or drama or other subjects. We're not asking them to, you know, invent, write a story based on something. We're just asking them to make up an answer. Tell me that you went on holiday to Spain. That's really not very fair. And there is a report by NALA around sort of inclusive and disadvantaged learners, and just making sure that when you plan your curriculum that you think, yes, am I delivering the things that I need to be able to do so that my learners can access the GCSE in 4 or 5 years' time? But actually, am I providing all learners the opportunity to meaningfully, authentically say what they want to say in a way that is creative and engaging? And again, if only we had more time. I think so much of it goes back to curriculum hours. And I think
that's what I would want them to do.
So thanks, Kerry. That brings us to the end of that deep discussion. And as you'll know, being a veteran of the podcast, we always set our guests some homework, the two infamous short slots. And you've decided to open with something to try.
So if they're in Wales, and even if they're in England, they might be interested in the fact that Welsh Government have funded the Stephen Spender Trust to provide literature professional learning for international language teachers in Wales for the next 3 years. So her work, so the work of Dr. Charlotte Ryland, who is the director of the Stephen Spender Trust, which is a charity, is all around creative translation. And it's all about using language creatively in the classroom and integrating that. So again, it's not tokenistic or an add-on, but it is actually embedded in the work that we do. So if listeners go to the Stephen Spender Trust and just type that into a browser, then I'm sure that they will find the website. But there is specific professional learning coming this way in Wales, so that's very exciting.
And you also work closely with me, working with mentors out there in our partnership, and you've got something quite subject specific, something of interest that our listeners might want to have a look at.
Yeah, so Routledge have published a series of mentoring specific books for the secondary classroom, and there is a Mentoring Languages Teachers. Our own Trevor Mutton also has a chapter in this book, and I think it's really it's a really useful book for mentors. It looks at roles, responsibilities, but it looks at these very subject specific things. Subject knowledge, what does that mean? How do we interpret that? How do beginning teachers? Looks at lesson planning process. So I definitely would recommend. The book is edited by Laura Mulway and Annalise Gordon from St Mary's Twickenham.
Kerry Bevan, thank you very much for another cracking episode. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
Sie haben Emma und Tom Talk Teaching gehört, einen Podcast über Bildung präsentiert von Emma Duher und Tom Breeze. Der besondere Gast dieser Folge war Kerry Bevan. Vielen Dank an Kerry für die Teilnahme. Das Podcast Kunstwerk stammt von Beth Blanford und die Musik stammt von Cameron Stewart. Wir sind in den sozialen Medien unter Talk Teaching Pod vertreten, wenn Sie uns begrüßen möchten. Wir werden in 2 Wochen mit etwas anderem Interessantem zurück sein. Bis dahin, seien Sie vorsichtig und genießen Sie den Unterricht.